You've just now been diagnosed with lung cancer. Now what? We have two clinical experts that will walk you through many of the questions you may be asking. Dr. Joan Schiller, the Chief Division of Hematology and Oncology and Deputy Director of Simmons Comprehensive Cancer Center and the President of the National Lung Cancer Partnership at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas, Texas. And Dr. Howard Jack West, the medical oncologist and medical director of the thoracic oncology program at Swedish Cancer Institute and the founder and CEO of GRACE, the global resource for advancing cancer education in Seattle, Washington. They are both experts in lung cancer. Dr. Schiller, would you like to start?
Sure, yes. Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be able to introduce this program for patients who are newly diagnosed with lung cancer on behalf of LungCAN, which is the Lung Cancer Action Network. LungCAN is a group of lung cancer organizations who have banded to work together in order to both raise public awareness about lung cancer as well as to increase funding for research so that we'll be able to detect, treat, and cure the disease earlier and better.
All right. We'll next move on to the question of what is cancer and specifically what is lung cancer. And turning to the question of how do cancers develop and what are they, cancer is a situation that occurs when normal cells, which are regulated in how they divide in a very careful way, become mutated at the genetic level so that they no longer have that self-regulation. And instead, they grow faster and they divide faster. And that leads to a process of the cancer cells growing larger and larger and displacing the normal cells around them. And this creates a tumor, essentially. So this is really caused by genetic damage that can be just a random finding that sometimes occurs, or it can be related to carcinogens, to things in the environment, whether that is tobacco or some other issues like radon or other factors in the environment that can lead to this genetic damage. Now, the next question is, what is lung cancer specifically? And it's a common issue that comes up that people might think that when you have a cancer that happens to be in the lung, that is always called lung cancer. But that is not exactly correct. In fact, many cancers metastasize, that is, spread to the lungs, because that is a place where there is a lot of blood supply. So cancer cells that circulate throughout the body from other sources may land there. Lung cancer is specifically a cancer that begins in the lung from cells that belong there. And so that is the difference between what is called a primary lung cancer and a metastatic cancer to the lung. And so if somebody has a breast cancer that goes to the lung or some other one, that's actually still a breast cancer. And by the same token, lung cancer can spread to other parts of the body, and yet it is still called lung cancer. Now, within the different types of lung cancer, there are actually two main forms. One is called small cell lung cancer, and the other is non-small cell lung cancer. And this is based on how they appear under the microscope when somebody has a biopsy. Now, non-small cell lung cancer is the more common subtype, about 80% or more. And in fact, what we've seen over the last several decades is a shift to more and more non-small cell lung cancer and small cell lung cancer becoming less common over time, really largely because small cell lung cancer is most associated with heavy smoking and even unfiltered cigarettes, and we're seeing patterns of change in smoking. Within the realm of non-small cell lung cancer, there's three main types. One is adenocarcinoma, another is squamous cell carcinoma, and the third, relatively uncommon, is large cell carcinoma. And again, this is based on how they appear under the microscope and sometimes the pattern of proteins that are seen on the cancer cells themselves. And so a pathologist helps clarify these. Sometimes it's not possible to tell which subtype it is because the cells look so chaotic that they really don't show any obvious pattern. And so sometimes we'll see something reported as non-small cell lung cancer, not otherwise specified or poorly differentiated.
So let's move on to molecular testing. So as patients move through their journey with cancer and lung cancer in particular, they're going to be hearing more and more about molecular testing.
So what is that? So molecular testing is testing a particular patient's tumor for specific genetic mutations. And the reason that we're doing that more and more is because scientists have found that many lung cancer patients can have the same genetic mutations. And for a couple of these genetic mutations, there are drugs which have been identified and made which are specific for the individual genetic mutations and are often very, very good for people with those genetic mutations. And the best example is a mutation in the epidermal growth factor receptor gene, which is also known as the EGFR gene. If a person has a genetic mutation in that gene, they stand an excellent chance of responding to a drug called erlotinib or Tarceva. A second example of a genetic abnormality is in something called the ALK, A-L-K gene. And if someone has an abnormality there, they stand an excellent chance to responding to a drug called crizotinib. So as an example of how we test for that is the panels that you're looking at, and I'm just going to focus on the one on the left. So what you're looking at there, the big blue blobs, are cancer cells. And in these cancer cells, you can see green dots and you can see red dots. And in a normal cancer cell, you should have a green dot and a red dot. You should have two pairs, and they should be close together. And you can see that in some of these cells. They're right next to each other. However, in some patients with cancer, these genes get rearranged, and now all of a sudden the green dot and the red dot are not next to each other anymore. They're spread apart. And sometimes this is called a break-apart assay, and it's a way of diagnosing ALK mutations. So the good thing is that we have at least two mutations for which we have drugs. The reality, however, is that only about 20% or so of all patients with lung cancer will have one of these two mutations. However, there are many, many scientists working very fast to identify many other types of mutations, and they have. And now there are many companies working very, very fast to identify drugs specific for those other types of mutations. So I think it's very appropriate for a patient to ask their physician about whether or not their tumor has been tested for some of these mutations, and if not, why not, and should it be.
I think one other point I'd bring up about molecular testing is the issue of what test results mean, because it's not just as simple as getting a copy of your reports, but rather having it put into context. There are some situations that might lead us to prioritize a molecular targeted therapy as the first treatment. There might be other test results that could lead us to prioritize chemotherapy instead, but it's complex, and frankly, it changes pretty frequently. And so it's not just an issue of getting a report back, but actually being able to talk about it with your oncologist to help provide context. And that context could be the experience that the physician has. It could also be specifically, what does this mean in terms of how I'm going to be treated? So that is really, it's not the end result, it's initiating what should be a dialogue. The other issues I'd like to bring up are that there are really advantages and some disadvantages to molecular testing. And we have historically thought of all of the advantages. There have been great strides made in lung cancer management, and a lot of that has been from molecular testing being done and having these relatively new targeted therapies that can be remarkably effective in patients who have a specific molecular target. And so that is certainly a leading argument to do widespread testing. But there are issues with that. It requires tissue to be sent off, and sometimes that can require an extra procedure, an intervention that generally has low risk, but it's not zero risk when you do an invasive procedure, whether that is a CT-guided biopsy or a bronchoscopy or some other procedure specifically to get additional tissue just for molecular testing. There are also really varying policies about what tests will be covered by one payer organization, insurer, et cetera, and different systems. And so it is certainly possible that there will be costs associated with some of these tests that might not be covered by a third party. And so it's really worth clarifying the risks and benefits for an individual patient. And the individual patient will have very often, by the features of their cancer and their own history, a much higher or lower chance of having some actionable result from the molecular testing. And so that is, I think, some of the issue that we address when we think about whether everyone should have molecular testing done or whether it should be done more selectively, because we don't necessarily want to incur risks and costs for people who have a very low probability of finding something that is going to change their treatment.
And I guess the last thing I would like to add is to remind everybody that for more information on molecular testing, you can visit the YouTube website, which is on the slide. One of the other things that patients are going to hear a lot about when they're diagnosed with any type of cancer, but including lung cancer, is staging. And staging is a way that physicians have to communicate to each other about their patients' disease and disease state and prognosis and treatment. And staging is based upon three things. It's based upon the size and location of the tumor. It's based upon whether or not that tumor has spread to any lymph nodes. And it's based upon whether it has spread to any other diseases, in this case, outside the chest. And what physicians do is they put these three things together: size and location of tumor, whether or not it's spread to lymph nodes, whether or not it has spread to organs outside the chest, and they come up with these stages. So for non-small cell lung cancer, a stage one, as a general rule, is a relatively small tumor with no lymph node involvement. Stage two, as a general term, usually includes lymph node involvement. Stage three means it includes even more lymph node involvement, including lymph nodes which are near the center of the chest called the mediastinal nodes. And then stage four means that the cancer has spread beyond the tumor and beyond the lymph nodes to other organs. And those other organs might be the other lung, brain, liver, bone, etc. And the reason, again, physicians do this is not only to be able to talk about prognosis when they just talk to other physicians, but also very importantly to talk about treatment, because a stage one patient's treatment is very different than a stage two versus a stage three versus a stage four, etc. Now, what I've just done talking about was about non-small cell lung cancer. Small cell lung cancer is often staged very differently. Because small cell tends to metastasize so very, very quickly, we often don't go into the details of whether or not it's spread to lymph nodes. And instead, we only basically have two stages for small cell: one, that it's confined to the lung, and secondly, that it's already spread. So to determine the stages of lung cancer, there are a variety of techniques that can be used. I think most lung cancer patients are aware of CT scans, which are a series of x-rays which slice the patient's body into a series of slices, much like a loaf of bread, for example, and then each one of the slices are taken out and projected on the screen. A PET scan is used to often help differentiate between tumor versus normal tissues. So sometimes what we see on the CAT scan, you can't really tell exactly what it is, and sometimes a PET scan can help determine whether that is cancer or not. And it can also help pick up cancer in places that we weren't suspecting them. So that is helpful often for looking at disease elsewhere in the body. To make the actual diagnosis of lung cancer requires a biopsy, as everyone knows. Sometimes, however, if one wants to know whether those lymph nodes are involved, which is important for differentiating stage one lung cancer from stage two, or from stage three, for example, we now have a special technique called EBUS, and basically what that is a bronchoscopy in which a pulmonologist inserts a small tube down through the trachea, the main breathing tube, and via a special attachment to this tube can sample lymph nodes which are surrounding the trachea and find out whether they contain cancer or not. An MRI is also a very good way for detecting abnormalities. It's particularly good in the head for looking for brain metastases, cancer that has spread to the brain. It turns out it is not really good in the chest, for example, because of the breathing motion associated, obviously, with our breathing, which can often kind of make a MR picture somewhat unreadable. So for the chest, we do primarily CAT scans and also PET scans.
So we'll move on to the topic of your healthcare team. And at this point, you may have already learned that medicine really has a lot of roles involved and that it's not about just having one doctor as much as having a team of people involved who may have different focus of interest and specialty, but they ideally will all be working in concert. And as you can see in this figure, you are at the center of that team. And more, patients themselves and their network, their friends, their families, are playing an active role in that, and that's a good thing. But I will be talking a little bit just about the role of the other people around you. And one is the primary care physician, who is often the first person involved when there's a new symptom that needs to be worked up, and that may lead to the diagnosis. It's important to note that the primary care physician is still ideally going to be involved at the care of the patient, especially when there are other medical issues than just the cancer. Another person is a nutritionist. Basically, having good nutrition is important for fighting the cancer and for someone's overall health, and many cancer centers have a dedicated nutritionist or several on staff, and so it's worth finding out about any specific recommendations. A physician assistant may work along with any of the physicians we're talking about, but more and more, nurse practitioners and physician assistants may be a real point of contact with whom a patient may have a lot of close contact. The thoracic surgeon is specifically involved with doing lung surgery for patients where that appears to be a good idea for their cancer. They are most commonly involved with the care of patients who have early stage lung cancer, but they may be involved in other settings like managing a pleural effusion, which is fluid outside of the lung, or other specific interventions that might be done to help a patient feel better, even if they don't have an early stage potentially curable disease by removing the cancer. But a thoracic surgeon specializes in lung cancer, and it's worth noting that outcomes tend to be best for lung cancer when patients see a specialized thoracic surgeon and not somebody who happens to do a little lung surgery along with a more general practice. The expertise really matters. Also closely aligned with the thoracic surgeon is the pathologist, so it certainly makes sense that they're right next to each other in the circle. The pathologist is the person who reviews the biopsy that is done to ultimately make a diagnosis, and it really does depend on the biopsy before we can say that someone has a final diagnosis of lung cancer. The appearance under the microscope defines a cancer and helps clarify that it originated in the lung. And the pathologist also can help define which specific subtype of lung cancer a person might have, if that is adenocarcinoma or squamous or some other type. And in fact, the pathologist role is becoming more and more important as many of our treatments become specialized to be found to work best for one subtype or another. Those subtypes are often defined by the pathologist. And then the pathologist also is involved with doing the molecular testing that is often guiding our treatment recommendations. So a very pivotal role. Medical oncologist is really often a quarterback or the quarterback of the team from the cancer perspective. Specifically, their leading role is to coordinate giving systemic or whole body therapies, which traditionally have been chemotherapy, but more and more include targeted therapies that might specifically hone in on the cancer and do less collateral damage to other parts of the body. The medical oncologist is often the person who is also coordinating the other specialists involved with the overall cancer care for the patient. And then along with that is the radiation oncologist, who has a specialty in delivering radiation that might be given with a goal of cure in some patients. There are several settings in which radiation is a core component of a potentially curable treatment plan. And radiation oncologists are often also called upon to provide relief of symptoms, to palliate pain in someone who has bone involvement from a metastasis or other symptoms. Maybe the cancer is causing compression of an airway and that needs to be shrunk as quickly as possible. Radiation is often very effective in that. An oncology nurse is often a critical point person working with a medical oncologist, sometimes a radiation oncologist, but they are often on the front lines of working with a patient, administering treatments, and often are a great resource in helping manage the side effects of the treatments or the symptoms of the cancer itself. An oncology social worker is often involved, often very helpful, for managing sometimes things that are very directly related to the cancer, coordinating options for how to pay for sometimes expensive medications or interventions. And they can also be a resource available in many cancer centers to help with other social work issues, such as getting additional support for people who are having a difficult time managing independently at home. A respiratory therapist is a technical support person who can help with breathing treatments and getting oxygen at home, and they often work very closely with a pulmonologist who is a lung specialist, not specifically focused on cancer, but on anything from helping optimize a patient's breathing to managing symptoms like a cough, and sometimes are called upon to help open up an airway with procedures, and they often will do the procedures that lead to a diagnosis, like a bronchoscopy. And in many cases, they remain involved with helping optimize a patient's lung function during the course of their treatment. A patient navigator is somebody available at many cancer centers to really help interface, work closely with the patient and their families, and just helping them navigate through what has become a pretty complex system. So they can help serve as an advocate and work with the patient and their family to know who to see and what resources are available. A palliative care specialist is someone who has become increasingly recognized for their value both in lung cancer and many other cancers, dedicated to helping manage side effects and optimize quality of life, and also managing the symptoms related to the cancer. Frankly, as much as that is a role for a medical oncologist, it's hard to cover everything with the same degree of focus, and a palliative care specialist can help ensure that everything from pain control to anxiety and depression and many other symptoms that limit a patient's quality of life can be addressed proactively. They may work with a psychologist as well, who is sometimes part of this team, and at many centers there are psychologists and or psychiatrists who work with cancer patients and their families to help with all of these processes, including coping with a challenging diagnosis and sometimes a terminal illness. So we'll move on to how to make informed decisions through teamwork. And I would say that teamwork is really the driving factor here. It's important nowadays for patients and caregivers to have an active role, to discuss with your doctor the right treatment approach. More and more resources are available through LungCan and through many of the other affiliated organizations that work with LungCan to help ensure that patients and caregivers have access to a lot of good education. And patients and caregivers, we would hope, will be able to engage and discuss the pros and cons of a wide range of potential treatment options. So it is important for patients to participate in these decisions rather than just passively accept a recommendation that comes from a doctor. Many times we will recommend that patients bring someone you trust to the appointments. It's always helpful to have another set of ears oftentimes when you're talking about high-stakes issues, it's easy to get transfixed on some things and not hear everything that is said. And with that, it's very helpful to have another person advocating for you, listening along with you. And also related to that is to be able to write down questions that arise between visits. Not everything that you might think of is going to happen right at the time of that visit, but it's still appropriate to address these concerns. And we do recommend that people write down the questions that you have, and they can be addressed whether it's through a phone call or at least ensuring that the next time you come in, you can ask those questions that are a high priority for you. And we'd also recommend that people document, to create a notebook to record your treatments, the side effects, and any other observations you have. Did some of your symptoms improve after treatment? Did they worsen? These can be valuable clues for your medical team to help clarify the probability that a treatment is working, to help suggest that a scan might be helpful to do sooner rather than later, or to clarify that there are issues that need to be addressed in terms of side effects. And so all of these are situations in which it is really helpful for patients and caregivers to play an active role. It is a complex business dealing with cancer, and it's a place where it would be very helpful to have the patient and caregiver engaged and actively play a very constructive, active role in that.
So prognosis. So prognosis can be a very scary word, but I think it's really important to remember that it's a term that describes how a group of patients is likely to do. I think it's very important to remember that how this group of patients is likely to do may or may not be generalizable to you. For example, when determining prognosis, physicians do that by looking at large numbers of patients from all over the world and looking at how they do in general. So you have to remember, it takes a long time to gather all this data, so it's usually old, and will often consist of patients who are treated with much older types of treatments, not necessarily something that you're likely to get. Also, because it includes all types of patients, it may include patients younger than you, patients older than you, patients sicker than you, patients with other types of problems than you. So you do have to remember that those are just statistics, which may or may not predict what will happen to you. For example, the prognosis of an elderly smoker from China, let's say, may be very different than the prognosis of a young woman in the States who's never smoked. Two different things entirely.
I think it's really helpful to just think that the statistics that we have and that we speak to give us a lot of information about how a population of people will do, but they really don't tell us how any one individual person will do.
Right.
And another thing just to think about is that the idea that we can tell someone that you have X months or Y years to live is really a fiction. It's the product of bad TV movies, but that's not reality. The truth is that even when we can provide some guidance, and I think we often can provide some realistic expectations, I think it's most helpful for physicians to express that as a range, an estimate that sometimes even people fall out of, but we really are not able to say that someone has X weeks or months to live. That's just not realistic, and I hope that physicians aren't stating things that way, and if patients are hearing that, that's really not what should be conveyed, that we really don't have that kind of precision, and we can only provide general guidance of what is realistic to expect. But there are certainly a wide range of outcomes in lung cancer, and that's becoming wider all the time with all of the new treatments that we are having made available.
Excellent point, Jack.
So let's turn to some of the general standard treatment approaches for lung cancer. And these are shown here, and I think it's appropriate to show that there is overlap, not just with supportive care, but that many of these treatment modalities often will overlap in our treatment plans. The circles to the left here show what we call local therapies, surgery and radiation that are directed to a specific point in the body, and they are the treatment of choice or a treatment of choice when the cancer is localized to a spot. surgery tends to be the leading consideration for patients who are healthy enough to undergo it and who have a cancer that is limited in its location to within the lung and perhaps some nearby regional lymph nodes. But surgery is not generally the treatment approach that would be recommended for people who have cancer that has spread far throughout the chest or in other parts of the body because it can't remove all of the cancer that way. And really, these local therapies are only going to be of greatest value in patients where you can remove or eradicate all of the cancer. Radiation therapy is given in a similar thought process as surgery. It works where you point it, and it can often cast a little wider net than surgery. It is not invasive, though it does cause some local damage from the burn effect of the radiation. But radiation can be used to be the main local treatment, often combined with chemotherapy for patients who have locally advanced or stage 3 cancer. It's sometimes used as a substitute for surgery in patients who are not great candidates for surgery because they have health issues or because they simply do not want to pursue surgery. And there have definitely been some significant advances in radiation for early stage disease that has made it a realistic alternative for some early stage patients. And then radiation as well can be used for palliating pain symptoms or other side effects in the setting of cancer. That may be treatment for coughing up blood, which is called hemoptysis, and radiation is often very effective for that. It can be effective for treating a painful spot in the bone or an area of bone that has a metastatic lesion that is compromising the structure of the bone and could lead to a fracture. It can be used to shrink a bulky tumor that is compromising breathing because it's compressing an airway. It can be used as the main treatment very often for patients who have brain metastases. That's not a curative setting, but it's a very reliable, our most reliable way to shrink cancer that has spread to the brain and often dramatically improve survival and disease control there. On the right side of the slide are a couple of circles for systemic therapies. Chemotherapy, which is essentially damaging the DNA of the cells, and that is historically what was our whole body therapy, generally given by vein, but there are some oral chemotherapies that are now available. And these are often given as a combination of two or more treatments. In lung cancer, it's often one or two chemotherapy agents given together, and if it's a combination, it's called a chemotherapy regimen or combination. And then targeted therapy is sometimes given alone. It's sometimes given along with chemotherapy. And this concept of targeted therapy is that what has evolved over the last decade or so is that we have more and more systemic treatments. They may be IV, they may be oral, but they go throughout the body anywhere that the bloodstream generally goes. And these treatments tend to be able to hone on a feature, a protein of the cancer, as opposed to the other cells of the body. So the goal is that you can have effective anti-cancer treatment without causing the bystander damage to as many parts of the body as we have tended to affect with chemotherapy. Although it's fair to say that many of our chemotherapy agents over the last decade or two have been more and more effective while causing less toxicity, fewer side effects. And so the concept that somebody got chemo and got very sick from it, therefore I don't want chemotherapy, is really an oversimplification. There are many different kinds of chemotherapy. They can be tailored to the specific cancer that someone has and the particular patient. And so what is right for one person may be very different for another person. And we really can't draw experiences of how one person did leading to an inevitable conclusion that the person in the room with you is going to do the same. And so I would hope that people can be open-minded about the possibility of what chemotherapy and as well what targeted therapies may do. The fact is we see just a lot of variability in how different patients tolerate sometimes even the same treatments. And then in the center of this is supportive care, and it's not mutually exclusive with any of these. It is part of, it's integral with all of these approaches, that there are going to be treatments to help address shortness of breath or pain or any of the issues that might come up to help ensure that patients have the best chance of getting through these treatments as comfortably as possible. And when these anti-cancer treatments aren't being given, there is still supportive care interventions that can be done to ensure that people are living as well as possible for as long as possible.
Jack, one other point I think about chemotherapy to remember is that different drugs have different side effects. And so just because a person got chemotherapy doesn't mean that it's the chemotherapy that you're likely to get, nor does it mean that they will have the side effects that you're likely to get. So they do differ a lot in terms of their side effects. And the other thing to remember for many patients is you can always try it just once. And if you don't tolerate it well the first time, you can always stop. It's not as if you've bought into this for 6 months or something like that. So let's talk about lung cancer clinical trials and what they are and why they are so important. And let me address that second question first, and that is all of our progress that we have made in cancer in general, including lung cancer, has been through clinical trials. Clinical trials is the mechanism by which we take scientific discoveries and drugs made or identified in the lab and finally get them approved by the FDA to treat patients. And to do that, you need to do clinical trials. And without patients participating in clinical trials, we would not be where we are today. So when talking about clinical trials, there's lots of considerations. I think, first of all, you need to know that all of these trials are very carefully monitored. Each institution has something called an institution review board to make sure that they are kind of legitimate, so to speak, that they are asking legitimate scientific questions and that patients are going to be getting all of the information. So there is a lot of regulations to go on to ensure patient safety. There are many different types of clinical trials. Some of these involve brand new drugs just coming out of the lab. Some involve comparing different types of drugs, some of the newer drugs with some of the older drugs. Some compare standard of care drugs, regular drugs, with new drugs. Some look at different types of surgical techniques or radiation techniques, lots and lots of different types of clinical trials. And there are lots of trials also for all states and stages of disease. Newly diagnosed disease, patients who are operable, patients who are inoperable, patients who their cancer has recurred, etc. So it's not at any particular point in your treatment that you should be asking about clinical trials. It would be from the very get-go because they're not necessarily directed for one particular type of disease. And I think you should ask your physician about participating in clinical trials. For one thing, there's been a lot of studies done that shows that even if the clinical trials don't turn out to identify a better type of treatment, that patients usually do better anyway when they're on the clinical trial. And that's primarily because they are followed much more closely. You will usually be assigned to a research coordinator or a research nurse who will be in charge of monitoring you and any side effects that you might be having, perhaps closer than your physician's team would otherwise be able to do. However, there are some things you need to know about these trials that you should definitely ask your physician about. Those include alternatives, what the standard treatment is, what other alternatives are. You should ask your doctor about any potential side effect or risks regarding the new treatment. You should definitely ask your physician about who's going to pay for it, the finances. Usually, for most places, if much of the treatment is what we call standard of care, so for example, the clinical trial may involve regular chemotherapy plus a new targeted agent. So for many patients, any costs associated with the regular chemotherapy, for example, is often paid by their insurance, whereas any costs associated specifically with the targeted agent may be billed to the study. But this is something you definitely need to talk about with the physician and the research coordinator. The other thing that you definitely need to talk with your physician about is whether or not there's a placebo involved. And a placebo is another word for a sugar pill or a fake pill. they are very, very, very rarely used in cancer patients. Extremely unusual, particularly to be used by themselves. Sometimes, like in the example I just gave, some patients may receive standard chemotherapy plus the new drug, and some other patients may receive standard chemotherapy plus a placebo, but in either case, all patients are getting standard chemotherapy. So usually, if a placebo is at all involved, it is involved with regular treatment as well, but this is something you definitely need to discuss with your doctor. In terms of finding a clinical trial, in addition to asking your physician, there are online resources for finding clinical trials, including one listed here on the lungcan.org website to help you identify clinical trials and where they may be closest to you.
I would just add that, of course, there are many motivations for patients to participate in clinical trials, and a leading one is to have access to a potentially promising new treatment before it's commercially available. And I completely agree that, you know, we have consistently seen that patients who participate in clinical research tend to have better outcomes than those who don't. What we've also seen is that one of the motivations that many patients have, and I'm sure you have patients in this situation, is that they're motivated also to move the field forward for those who follow, that this is a scary situation and options are never as great as we would like. And so ideally, it will help them personally. But even if it increases our understanding and if it leads to new options becoming available for the next people who are facing this, I think that's a terrific thing. And it always humbles me to see patients who are so altruistic that they're thinking not just about themselves, but about the cancer community and the lung cancer community and trying to improve the outcomes for the people who follow them.
I couldn't agree more with you, Jack. I think one reason why oncologists are so passionate about clinical trials is because it's the only way we make progress in terms of treating lung cancer patients. There are clinical trial matching services, as indicated on this slide. There's a phone number listed on this slide that can help you find a lung cancer clinical trial. Again, you can try the lungcan.org website, or another website that is listed on this slide is emergingmed.com. website as well.
So let's turn to symptom management, because that's certainly an important part of lung cancer. And as you can see here on this slide, there are a wide range of potential symptoms, and this is not a complete list. As a general rule, I think it's worth pointing out a few key issues. One is, it is definitely worth having good communication with your oncologist and their office team. It is important to not assume that these symptoms are something you should have that are normal and that you just have to live with. Very often, symptoms may be indicative of something that could be reversible, but they will only be able to be reversed if other people on your medical team know about them. And so it is absolutely worth discussing these issues that you're having to clarify first whether it is more likely to be from the underlying cancer than side effects of the treatment, because it can be hard to tease them apart, and sometimes many symptoms will overlap with side effects from treatment. And there may or may not be a very effective way to intervene against them. So just looking at some of these, pain or discomfort is something that in most cases we should be able to control effectively. And it may be a moving target. People may have more pain at the time of their diagnosis and hopefully less as their treatment is being given. It may worsen as the cancer progresses, but there are a range of treatments that can be done for pain that may be opioid medications. It may be just non-steroidal medicines. It may be radiation or other treatments, but it is absolutely worth talking with your medical team, because there are such a wide range of short-term and long-term medications. There's just no reason for people to be in more pain than they have to be. Cancer is not treated by pain, and so it's something that people should not have to live with. A cough is something that we also do see commonly in patients with cancer, and some of our treatments can lead to a cough. For instance, radiation, particularly when given with chemo at the same time, can lead to an inflammation in the lungs, and that can be a cause for a cough. There may be good treatments for this that could range from just a cough syrup or some other cough suppressant to steroids. Sometimes coughing can be an indicator of an infection that can be treated with antibiotics. Loss of appetite may be related to the cancer itself or our treatments. It may be something that should have the treatment adjusted to see if that makes a difference, but there's also several medications that could be given to help improve appetite. And we do want to prioritize this issue because patients who are well-nourished can certainly tolerate the challenges of treatment better than those who are losing ground and losing weight. A fever is an important one, and one that I think most oncologists say, and they all should say, is something to contact your oncologist about anytime. And that should include day or night, weekends, anytime. For patients who are on cancer chemotherapy, we will often see their blood counts go down, and that is associated with some increased risk of infection when the blood counts, and particularly the white blood cell count, gets low. And that can occur even with very appropriate normal use of chemotherapy. But if someone has a fever in that setting, it is often a situation where if they have low blood counts, they should receive IV antibiotics. And so that is a factor that should definitely be discussed whenever there's some concern about a fever. Weight loss, as I mentioned, in terms of loss of appetite, is an indicator of a challenge with getting through treatments. And so we definitely want to try to deal with this proactively. And there are medications that can help patients eat better. They may be related to nausea, vomiting, et cetera, but it's worth assessing why that weight loss might be occurring. Fatigue can be from several different things. It can be related to the chemotherapy itself as an expected side effect. It may be related to anemia, low blood counts, low red blood cell counts from chemotherapy. But there are several potential causes for fatigue, and some of them are reversible. And so it is definitely worth discussing with your doctor to see whether there might be some treatable component of that or adjustment in the treatment schedule to accommodate this issue. And then difficulty breathing. That could be related to the underlying cancer. It could be related to a side effect of one of our medicines, that it is possible some of the chemo agents, some of the targeted therapies can lead to inflammation in the lungs. Could be an infection. It could be the underlying cancer, but there are different treatment approaches for any of these that can lead to improvements. It may be that patients, regardless of the cause, will need supplemental oxygen. Some patients will feel relief with adding morphine, which can relieve the sense of air hunger, at least in some patients. And so there are a wide range of potential treatment approaches, and it is just worth underscoring that you need to have that good communication, that the medical team can only address the issues that they happen to know about, and that many of these do have a reversible component that can lead you to do better by bringing it up. Turning to some additional symptoms to address, they're shown in this slide, and one of them is skin changes. Several of our newer medications, including the EGFR, or epidermal growth factor receptor inhibitors, targeted therapies, but also some other ones, are known for leading to a rash or other skin side effects. And sometimes the oncologist has become experienced enough to deal with a lot of these. Sometimes it may be worth having a dermatologist involved to try to address these issues. And sometimes, frankly, other patients who have been on these agents can be helpful. There might be even online resources to talk about these options. But very often there are interventions to help address skin changes that can be associated with chronic administration of these drugs. And so the ability to manage these symptoms can really be the difference of being able to stay on a treatment longer term. Nausea and vomiting are common side effects of our treatments. They can be related as well to the cancer itself. One of the biggest advances in the field over the last 20 to 30 years is that our anti-nausea drugs have become so much better that even when we use some of the oldest drugs that are still very effective in lung cancer or other cancers, patients don't necessarily have to deal with the same level of nausea and vomiting that they used to because of the great advances in nausea medicines. And it's worth noting that these are routinely given at the time that chemo is administered, but it's often very appropriate for patients to have some of these medicines at home as needed if they experience nausea and vomiting at home. The other thing worth noting is that nausea is a symptom that can be addressed best when it's mild, that you don't want to wait until someone has really problematic nausea and vomiting. But just when you feel it first coming on, it can often be effective to nip it in the bud rather than give it a real toehold and become problematic. Anemia is another symptom I've mentioned in passing. Anemia is a low red blood cell count, and that can be treated effectively with blood transfusions if it is significant enough. Other times, perhaps a break in treatment may be indicated, adding supplemental iron or other interventions. There are some medications that we can give to help raise the level of red blood cell production that are sometimes used, but certainly there are effective interventions for anemia. And then bleeding. Now, bleeding may be caused by the cancer itself. It may be associated with some of our treatments, but it's always something worth bringing up. There are often effective treatments that may be radiation. It may be a signal that a patient may need additional platelets, which are one of the core components that are involved with the regulation of bleeding. Many patients are on blood thinners for one reason or another. Blood clots are unfortunately quite common in lung cancer and other cancers, and so these blood thinners may need to be adjusted if someone is having bleeding, but it's always worth bringing up bleeding when that is occurring. Eating problems. I mentioned the difficulty that some patients have with appetite. There's nausea, vomiting, there's weight loss. Sometimes people will experience difficulty with swallowing that might be related to the cancer pressing against the esophagus and limiting the ability to swallow. Sometimes when radiation is given, it'll lead to inflammation of the esophagus. These are issues that can be addressed with medications. Occasionally, people will even need to have a feeding tube placed to help them have maximal support to get through what would hopefully be just a short period of difficulty. And radiation or a stent might be put into the esophagus to help with swallowing. And then infections. Now, infections may be a pneumonia, it may be a urinary tract infection, it could be all sorts of things, but they do occur. There is a potentially increased risk of infections when someone has depressed immune function from the cancer treatments or potentially the cancer itself. There are even some issues like shingles that can develop in people when their immune system is depressed from our treatments. And so these tend to be effectively treated if we can identify the problem. So it is absolutely imperative to be in good communication with your doctor, have your situation evaluated, because an infection can usually be treated quite effectively once it is clarified what is going on. So all of these are important issues, and the most important thing is to have a low threshold for communicating with your oncologist or other members of the healthcare team. There's no need for people to suffer with these at home and just wait 2 or 3 weeks until they're going to see the doctor again.
So, living with lung cancer. So cancer is a journey. It's a whole new way of life, and it will involve certainly more than just going to the doctor occasionally. One of the things that will certainly involve is finance. Cancer treatments are often very expensive. It's very important that you speak with your healthcare team at the beginning about the cost of care. For those who are uninsured or need financial assistance, often many major cancer centers have social workers that can help with this. Again, there are also websites on which you can find information on financial assistance, including the lungcan.org website. The other thing about cancer, however, is it's a journey, as I said, and it involves a new community. And it's very important for you to proactively figure out the community that you want to be part of and you want to welcome into your area. For example, support groups can often be very helpful for some people who otherwise can feel very isolated as they go through their cancer experience. You want to find the best physician for you, not only in terms of their medical knowledge, but you want to find a physician that will communicate well with you, that will listen to you, that will understand your concerns, and that will be there all of the time. If you can't find that person or you have doubts, consider getting a second opinion. I would say that most oncologists don't mind or feel threatened by a second opinion, and it can often be very, very helpful in terms of reassuring someone that they are getting the best treatment. The other thing is that it's very important to know that an educated patient is going to be the most effective patient. And it's very important, I think, for you to know what is going on and know what is going on with lung cancer in general, know what is going on with you and your health and your treatments. The more educated you can become about this process, clearly the better. And then lastly, I think, is that many patients don't want to, quote unquote, bother their family and friends. And I would really like to encourage patients to rethink this for several reasons. One of which is that you really do need to take care of yourself. You will not be able to do everything that you've always been able to do without a pause. This is going to affect your life. And so your first priority is to take care of yourself. Family and friends often really, really do want to help. They don't consider you a burden. And in fact, they feel bad if you deprive them of this opportunity to help. And I think that's what many cancer patients don't realize. The silver linings behind cancer is that it often brings family and friends together. And so many times I have heard so many patients say that because of this cancer experience, they found out how much their family really loved them, how many friends they had, etc. So I would highly encourage you to communicate with your family and friends and give them the opportunity and the privilege of helping you. The other thing is in addition to taking care of the cancer, you need to take care of the rest of your body and your mind and your spirit. And so finding people to help with that as well. And again, this I think is where palliative medicine can come in. Its goal is to help relieve the physical and emotional symptoms associated with your disease or your treatment with your disease. And then, of course, at some point, families have to face the question of hospice. And hospice is a word for an organization that treats patients with incurable cancers at home as much as possible. And so it provides not only nursing support, but other support as well. For example, pharmaceutical support. It gets people drugs or equipment, or it can provide respite in the homes, meaning it can help someone come in so that your family member can take a break and go out shopping, that type of thing. Palliative care is care that is directed at reducing symptoms. And those symptoms can be physical, they can be emotional, but it is designed to reduce symptoms. So anybody with symptoms is certainly eligible for palliative care. Sometimes, in fact, most frequently probably, the patient's primary medical oncologist is the one who manages the patient's symptoms and thus therefore manages palliative care. However, more and more now we are seeing specialists whose specialty is, in fact, managing the symptoms associated with cancer. This is very different than hospice. Hospice is, again, a word for an organization which manages multiple things for patients with terminal disease. Yes, they also manage symptoms, but they also manage drugs, equipment, emotional support. It's a much bigger series of services very specifically for patients with terminal disease. So be sure to ask your team about each of these as well.
So to close, I would just like to underscore that LungCAN, the Lung Cancer Action Network, wants to help here. And it's worth reiterating that LungCAN is a collection of organizations dedicated to the fight against lung cancer. We're all working together against a common enemy here. You can see from this slide the wide range of different organizations that are committed to this process, and they are all working together to focus on maximizing education for patients to become involved with their own care and for committing funding to this fight, because we would hate to be limited in what we can do by the budgets. And so it is definitely worth increasing awareness. And with that awareness comes greater funding for lung cancer. And then also to facilitating the process of clinical research, because it is clinical research that leads to a greater understanding of how best to treat lung cancer, and it leads to new treatments for the future. And so all of these different organizations are committed to this process.
And I think just to stress how important this process is when you look at what other types of diseases, what they've accomplished by advocacy, patient advocacy and awareness and funding research. Breast cancer, for example, the survival rates have gone up dramatically with more and more research and more people clamoring for more and more research. And there are certainly other diseases as well. So I, too, cannot overemphasize the importance of patient advocacy and participating in organizations such as the ones that LungCan represents.
Great.
Thank you.
One other point I would make is that the many organizations involved and shown here each have their own websites, and it would be helpful for many people to check those out because they all have some overlapping mission involved, but there are individual strengths and focuses of the various groups here. So I'd encourage people to check out those websites and also to check out the website for LungCan itself, which is at LungCan, LungCan.org. So please check those out and you'll learn more.
Thank you.